Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
He composed pieces for prepared piano. However, listeners and critics were often unprepared. This is Soundcheck. I'm Elliot Forrest, in for John Schaefer. Today, the daring life of John Cage. And we'll hear about the first preview performance of the much-talked-about Spider-Man musical on Broadway. Plus, the Los Angeles-based indie band Warpaint plays live in our studio. To begin, John Cage was an unconventional composer, to say the least. He used coin tosses and the I Ching as creative tools. Works like this one that we're listening to, the sonatas and interludes, are performed with a piano and objects inserted inside. And he's best known for the work 4 Minutes, 33 Seconds, in which a musician sits in silence for, well, not quite 5 minutes. John Cage died in 1992, but his life is the subject of the new book, Begin Again. And I'm joined in studio by its author, Kenneth Silverman. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, Elliot.
A lot has been written about John Cage in the past. What's different about this book? Is it that you want to give us a picture of his whole life?
Well, probably the main difference, Elliot, is that earlier people writing about Cage did not use his correspondence. I mean, Cage was a very enthusiastic and letter writer and left several thousand letters. And these letters are filled with biographical information, and they really have not been used before. I did a lot of research in, Chicago and in Los Angeles and all over the place, putting these letters together. So I would say there's a lot of new biographical information in the book.
Was it difficult to get access to this new material?
No, I was it was costly. I mean, staying, a couple of weeks in Chicago or Los Angeles. But I was greatly helped by the John Cage Trust and its director, Laura Kuhn. They really have control over Cage's papers.
And what did these letters reveal to you that we didn't know before about John Cage?
Well, first of all, a lot of very intimate detail about his personal life. I mean, Cage, of course, spent most of his life living with Merce Cunningham as a couple. But before then, he had some, very intense relationships with women, had been married to one of them, a gifted artist named Zdeněk Kachavarov, whose father was the head of the Alaskan Greek Orthodox Church, and she was herself part Inuit, part Eskimo. I cover that in a way that, had not been covered before, including their very painful breakup.
I want to get into detail about some of these relationships, particularly Merce Cunningham. I've had the opportunity to interview him twice, and we always end up talking about John Cage. But let's talk about this one piece that really put John Cage on the map and certainly had a lot of people talking. This 4 minutes, 33 seconds, this was 1952. Why was that such a lightning rod in his life?
Well, it's a strange piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. But I much regret it. I mean, Cage's musical imagination was so much broader than that. And people get stuck on 4:33 and even on the prepared piano pieces. But he worked in many, many different musical forms and styles. I mean, to me, the great thing about Cage is exactly Begin Again. You finish with that, and you go on to something else. You go on to something new. And Cage was constantly going on to something new. And it's a shame that 4:33, interesting though it is, has kind of become identified with him. It really robs us of a lot of other music that he did.
We'll give him his due on his other pieces. I just want to just ask a little bit more about the 4:33, if I could, because when you read accounts of it, you see that people started to listen differently. They started to hear differently. Did it change the way people listen to the world around them and to music?
Well, Cage certainly changed the way that I listened. I mean, Cage's point always was that you don't hear music, you listen to music. There's a vast difference. And, and after working with Cage, I myself started listening to sound in a way I never had before. Before 433 cage and going up to Harvard in some so-called soundless chamber where there was completely without echoes or anything. And yet he heard noises, and it was explained to him the noises he was hearing were internal noises. They were the noises of his own bodily system. So Cage, you know, came to understand there is no silence. There is no such thing. The people who sat through that 433 in Woodstock, was it Woodstock, New York, just were listening to all the sounds outside, pattering on the roof and the birds and, you know, wind and so on. Plenty of sound was going on, plenty.
What were what was the audience reaction and the critics' reaction to the piece at the time?
Well, some people took it seriously for what it was. I mean, it was a demonstration that sound is omnipresent. There is no escaping it. Others, you know, just found it amusing. The person who performed it, the pianist David Tudor, who was a phenomenal pianist. I mean, nothing could be more unlike Tudor than that, because Tudor had tremendous skill, could play very, very difficult music. But he later said it was a very intense thing for him to play, to watch at exactly the right time, to close the lid of the keyboard. And he said, you have no idea how intense it is to play that piece.
And this piece, 433, has actually been recorded.
Oh, yes. There are several recordings of
Silence. Do you have a favorite recording of this piece?
Oh, gosh. I must somewhere. I'm not sure which one it is. Yes.
And was there an ideology behind this? Was it about performance art? What was it for Cage that he wanted to do this?
Well, early on, Cage, he worked with a film director once who told him that everything has a sound inside it that can be released. Cage took that very, very literally. The world is full of sounds. I mean, when we think of music, I mean, most people think of music, almost everyone thinks of Western classical music. Music is Brahms and it's Mozart and it's Haydn and so on and so forth. These are very, very conservative musical audiences. So for one thing, I mean, there are hundreds of musics, and whether they're Thai music or African music, those are music too. But Cage felt that we haven't even begun to hear all the sounds that are really available to us. He even wanted at one point to try to get the sounds of mushrooms growing. He's quite serious about that. But the world of sound is immense, and with the possibilities for bringing those sounds together in some musical form, you know, endless.
Elliot Forrest here in for John Schaefer. You're listening to Soundcheck. My guest is Kenneth Silverman. His new book is called Begin Again, A Biography of John Cage. We're going to hear a piece from 1948, and I think that's the amazing thing about John Cage. Performance art, unusual, strange, but we have to remember this is the late 40s, early 50s when we're hearing some of these pieces. In a landscape, what should we know about this?
In a landscape? My recollection is exactly how it put it together. That's faded, I'm afraid.
This piece is actually from 1948. This recording we're listening to is from 1991, and it's pianist Margaret Lang Tan, some music of John Cage. Let's take a listen. Pianist Margaret Lang Tan, music from 1948 in a landscape, by John Cage. If I were to play this and tell people it was Wyndham Hill in the 80s or 90s, you might have believed that it was some New Age music, but because this is very accessible. How does this differ from a lot of the other John Cage music?
Well, let me say first, Margalang Tan is a marvelous Cage pianist. In fact, if you listen to his earlier works in the 1940s, there are some marvelous, fairly straight, you know, conventional as I wouldn't say, but rather like this, great early piano works. You listen to Bacchanal or his wonderful piece about Hamlet. They're very accessible and very, very exciting to listen to. Later on, I mean, he got away from anything as straightforward as this, you know.
Your new book about John Cage is called Begin Again. You touched on this just a moment ago when we started, but maybe a little more on why the title. Why Begin Again is the title of the book?
Well, Cage was, first of all, the hardest working person I've ever known anything about. He worked day and night, really endlessly, and left a tremendous body of work of all kinds. But the phrase comes from Cage himself, where he says at one point, I am beginning again. When he finished a kind of music, he went on to something new. One of the best things I know said about Cage was said by the wife of Marcel Duchamp, and she said about Cage, he loved everything and nothing. That is, he really entirely entered into whatever he was doing with tremendous devotion and passion, and he could just drop it like absolutely nothing and go on to something completely different.
Let's talk a little bit more about his relationships. You mentioned that he was passionately involved with women and then men, Merce Cunningham particularly. Give us the highlights of really what is an extreme power couple to have this amazing composer meet up with this amazing choreographer-dancer.
Well, I'm glad you spoke about power a couple. One of the things I think must be done in New York City, I hope somebody's listening, we have plaques out there for Emma Lazarus and for Washington Irving and for all kinds of other people. Cage and Cunningham lived together in a loft on 18th Street. There has to be a plaque up there for these two extraordinary people who shared a life there. They, of course, worked together in Merce Cunningham's dance company. Cage wrote music for the dances, although their policy was he wrote a piece and Cunningham wrote a dance. Didn't have to do anything with each other. There wasn't any sense of writing music for this dance, just writing a piece of music and choreographing a dance and play together.
But that plays into a lot of the philosophy of both of them, of accident and seeing what happens.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Surprise. And you know, there's a kind of Buddhist Zen kind of quality to all of that, too, about the multiplicity of things in the world. Cage, you know, had studied Zen Buddhism for a while and was very influenced by it. They not only worked together. Cage for a while was on the board of the dance company. A very, very generous person he was. He often gave money that he earned to the company to support the dancers, and became, you know, very friendly with some of the dancers. So, you
know. Do you know how John Cage first met Merce Cunningham?
Yes, well, they had been in California teaching at the Cornish School, I think it was called. It was in Washington State, I believe. And Merce Cunningham was actually studying theater there. He really wanted to be in the theater. And Cage was teaching music and leading a kind of little percussion group. And they just happened to meet. Actually, Cunningham, however, went to New York. He was going to dance, I think, with the Martha Graham Company. And when Cage later got to New York, they saw each other again, having worked together at the Cornish School in, I believe, Washington State. And that was it. They became very deeply involved until the end, when love somehow broke up, and Cage was, you know, very, very, very deeply hurt by the breakup of their relationship.
Kenneth Silverman's new book is about John Cage. It's called Begin Again. Elliot Forrest sitting in for John Schaefer here on Soundcheck. A couple of years ago, I stumbled upon a YouTube video of John Cage on the old game show, I've Got a Secret, and I've been so captivated by it for many, many years. And you write about it in your book.
Oh, it was a hilarious event. Well, the thing is, Cage, in Milan, he had been on a very popular, the most popular TV show in Italy. It was the Italian equivalent of Double or Nothing. And by answering questions about mushrooms, which interested Cage very much, he took home the big prize. He kept doubling and doubling and doubling. Came back with, I don't remember, $100,000 or something like that. And with a sort of reputation as a TV personality. And they got him, Gary Moore, I guess, Gary Moore's producer, got him to appear on I've Got a Secret. It was a marvelous show because Cage's, another person on the show was Zsa Zsa Gabor.
On that same episode?
On the same episode.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, Zsa Zsa's secret was that she was actually wearing a potato sack.
What people should know if they don't know the game show is basically people have a secret, they come on, and there's a panel that they try to guess what that person's secret is. In this particular case, they were trying to guess that John Cage was a composer, and they pretty much just give up on the game and have him play. So let's hear the setup. This is from Gary Moore from the 1960 broadcast of the television show I've Got a Secret.
Inevitably, Mr. Cage, these are nice people, but some of them are going to laugh. Is that all right?
Of course. I consider laughter preferable to tears.
How sweet is that? So they do the setup, and they talk about it, and then they completely abandon the game altogether, which they never play in this particular episode, in favor of just having John Cage play. And basically, you have this in your book, you list, 30 or 50 items that are on the set, including a big tub, and there's bunches of ice and flowers and a frying pan and radios. Let's go ahead and take a look. Yeah, there we go. Let's listen to it. I'm wondering what Cage was thinking about this, and indeed, was this performance art for him? As he said, he preferred laughter to tears. He didn't mind that the audience was laughing.
Among his other great qualities, Cage had a great sense of humor. Very, very amusing, very, very funny guy. And he respected, comedy. I think that he meant this just as a big joke, although, there's an underlying kind of seriousness in his knocking radios off the table and kicking the tub and so on, for the sounds. But Cage had a great sense of entertainment. There's no doubt about that.
There was certainly throughout his life a lot of criticism aimed at Cage. How did he handle that?
Oh, he didn't care at all. He often said that the criticism never got to him. He was just doing his thing. The only time it got to him was when it sometimes became sort of physical, as happened once or twice. I remember one performance he gave in Italy where a bunch of people rushed up on the stage, took off his glasses, took away his cup. Another time in a very famous episode, the TV artist Nam June Paik stopped playing a piece of music, got off the stage, took his scissors and cut off his necktie and part of his coat. That bothered him, but criticism didn't, ordinary criticism didn't bother him at all.
Is it fair to say that the visual art world embraced John Cage at that time even more than the musical world?
Oh, some of Cage's closest friends were painters, including, Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg, very important 20th century painters. Cage himself belonged to the Arts Club in New York that was filled with very, very well-known painters. He later in his career, he started taking up engraving and painting himself. And as with everything else, he began again. I mean, he took up one kind of engraving technique, dropped that, started another kind of engraving technique. He became quite a serious artist, and I think it was Rauschenberg who said he was glad that Cage's works hadn't been hung in the same show as his, because Cage's were better.
We're going to hear a piece from 1991, which is the year before John Cage died. Did his music change, or how did his music change towards the end of his life?
Yes, well, those late pieces, as I say, Cage was a very, very lively, very enjoyable person. But I think when he broke up with Merce Cunningham, he was very depressed, very unhappy. And I think you hear it in some of these very late pieces.
Here's an excerpt from Cage's last composition for percussion, completed in 1991. It's called 4-4, performed by the Amadinda Percussion Group. The four players can choose their instruments themselves. It's 72 minutes long, designed to squeeze into a traditional CD. Let's take a listen. The last composition for percussion John Cage wrote, a piece from 1991 called 4-4. 2012 is fast approaching. That will be the 100th anniversary of John Cage's birth. What should we expect that year?
Well, there are many, many exhibits and shows in progress. The John Cage Trust is arranging several things. I think there's a good chance that the Museum of Modern Art is going to have some big Cage exhibition, too, although in the past they've exhibited some of Cage's visual art. There'll be a lot of programs. A thing I'm hoping for very much is that we can get the government to issue a John Cage stamp in his honor.
Author Kenneth Silverman, a Pulitzer Prize winner. His book is called Begin Again, a biography of John Cage. Thank you so much for being on Soundcheck.
Thank you, Elliot.
Up next, Spidey has landed on Broadway. We hear about the first performance of the new $65 million musical, Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. And later, the L.A.-based band Warpaint joins us for a live performance in the Soundcheck studio. I'm Elliot Forrest, and today for John Schaefer, this is Soundcheck.